Welcome to Marketing Made Clear. I'm your host, Will Green. Today's episode is a bonus episode which covers my recording with Mike Hansen, who's had an illustrious career in radio and more recently in podcasting with his company Pod People Productions. This is such an insightful chat, so I hope you're locked in and ready. And with all bonus episodes comes a bonus theme song. I haven't covered punk in any form yet, so I thought it'd be rude not to, or punk ska anyway. The episode will be structured with an intro, the recording itself, and then a bit of a reflection from me at the end, where I relate some of the conversation to other things that might be of interest. Are you ready?
Marketing Made Clear. We're here to educate from beginners to pros. We'll elevate, bringing the insights like a blazing spark. Together we'll conquer, leaving our mark.
So Mike Hansen is the founder and director of Pod People Productions and Thelonious Punk Production. And what a cool name that is, with reference to Thelonious Monk, who was a prolific jazz pianist and composer who rose to fame in the 40s. He is known to be pretty innovative in his compositions. But Mike has over 30 years experience in the radio and music industry, with nearly 20 years experience at the BBC, producing at both Radio 2 and BBC 6 Music. And Mike has also produced on Talk Radio too. As a London resident, but originally from Canada, Mike has worked with some of the biggest names of broadcasting. His podcasts include Egypts of the World with Andrew Maxwell and Glenn Wool. And Glenn Wool actually is someone I've seen a few times at stand-up shows. He's a very funny guy. Andrew Maxwell is the voice of X on the Beach, and both of these dudes are about as funny as it gets. Then LVB Presents with Steph Thompson, the Dr. Richard podcast, Namaste Mother Truckers, let's say, with Kelly Beaton. Kelly being a beast in the media world with her background in MTV, UK TV, Viacom, CBS, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, Paramount, the list goes on. What an inspirational character Kelly is, by the way. And the Hapori podcast with Rob Solly. Sisters in the Shadows with the supremely talented Colette Cooper, Colette being Mike's partner in crime with their lovely pup Billy. And Mike and Pod People have an amazing portfolio of podcasts, so please do check out Pod People Productions to see the full list. But I of course know Mike and first met Mike as the producer of the wonderful Anna Webb's A Dog's Life. So let's dive into the conversation with Mike. Thelonious Punk Production, which is an awesome name, by the way. Love that.
That's a funny one, because I'd always wanted, I always thought it was a cool name for a band.
And yeah.
I had a sort of side project where I was kind of singing, I can't really sing, but it just bore out of it. It was a mixture of a couple guys from my band and a couple guys from Colette's band, and we were just did a couple gigs with, I had to come up, and so I called it Thelonious Punk, and then when I was going to jump ship from BBC, which you get to in a minute, I wanted to do Pod People
Production.
Yeah. That was going to be the main focus. And then we thought, well, we're also going to do music. Might do a record label, going to do Colette's Play and all that. So that maybe I'll come up with a different company name. Colette's Orange called Thelonious Punk. And I said, all right. And I thought, cool. But like some people don't get it. So even people send me invoices called the Thelonious. But when I registered it with companies, I spelled it wrong, so I had a nightmare fixing that.
Yeah.
And I registered it with a proper business account with Lloyd's. And again, I had trouble with the woman. She kept getting it wrong. I kept going back in. And then I went in to get some, funny enough, a checkbook like I never used. A checkbook. And then she said, oh, by the way, our manager wants to meet you. He thinks your company name is really cool.
So really?
The bankers go, oh, brilliant name, man. That's cool. So people who get it really love it. People who don't understand the joke get it wrong, spell it wrong. So
I'd say it wrong probably as well.
Yes.
If you don't know, it might sound Greek or something. I don't know. Yeah, and on Talk Radio as well.
Yeah, I was at the original Talk Radio.
Yeah.
And in fact, until I joined Radio 2, I had never, every radio job I had was at the startup, at the entry level. So my first job in radio was when I was 16, working with my dad, because he opened a country radio station in Calgary.
Nice.
He was a radio outlet. When we moved out there, so he launched, he opened a new country radio station, and that was my first job in radio, is doing being a tech op overnight, playing out all the records.
Yeah.
And my second job was at, it was a radio, an ongoing radio station, but they reformatted to be all sports.
Okay.
So when it became an all sports station, so that was my second job in radio. And then I left and I got to the UK and looked for jobs, and they launched Talk Radio UK. So I was there for that launch, and I was there until it rebranded to Talk Sport. I was there for that.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I joined Six Music, which is new, brand new. So all my career in radio was always explaining people what I did, because no one ever heard what I know. Like, well, what's that? You know, and to radio was the first established brand I ever joined that was already a thing that people understood what I was talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a culture shock, because I had no shape on it. It was kind of, what sort of impact can I have on this big beast that's already been around for 50 years that everyone knows about?
Yeah.
That's part of the question with that. One of the reasons I left. And so when I started making podcasts, so the fact that no one knew what the fuck I was talking about was a podcast.
Yeah, you're used to that.
Explaining to people what I'd actually did.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I did talk to Anna a little bit about the move from, you know, radio into podcasting. And I think I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, because we're both like from the music background as well, but it's like moving from live performance and live recording into like a studio recording environment, in a sense that, you know, radio is going out live predominantly, whereas the podcast, you know, you do have that, the option of editing and all sorts as well.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, actually, to perfect analogy between live performance, recording it, and then taking it. The thing about with live radio is that you have to get it right, and it sharpens your mind. And I always found this when I was in radio, if we were recording anything, knowing that if you made a mistake, you could do it again. It's a bit of a safety net for people.
Yeah,
presenters, but also it kind of makes them a bit unfocused. So you end up doing 400 takes because they couldn't get it. But if you gave it to them live on air, they nailed the first time. That would be it.
Yeah,
and it's the same with if you're playing live in an event, you got to get it right. You can't say, well, I'll re-record that bit, because you can't.
Yeah,
it's a good analogy to make, actually.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think as a musician, I always find, when I'm practicing and doing stuff at home, I'm never as good as live.
No.
Like, I'll nail it live because I don't look an idiot.
Yes.
It's a big driver. But, and like, since you've made the move into podcasting, like, you've got a hell of a portfolio there with Pod People.
Mm.
Amazing. I think I was looking through them, and I know the Egypts of the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually, Glenn Wall, I saw him, he was supporting Frankie Boyle on a tour, and I thought it was hilarious. And then I checked out a few other bits and, of his, like the, I think he did a live at the Apollo and all sorts, something along those lines. And yeah, he's hilarious. And he's a countryman of yours, isn't he?
Yeah, he's from, Vancouver.
Yeah.
I mean, my initial mission statement, the thing that is covering all life, culture, and it was designed to be a bit broad, because I knew I'd want to probably do comedy, and I would probably want to do music as well, but there would other things would come up, and so I just thought, well, I kind of keep, rather than be just known for one genre, like true crime.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was a mistake or not, because wondering, some of these big publishers are known for a particular type of style or a particular genre, but I my interests are all over the place, and the ability to do a dog podcast and then do a comedy one in the afternoon, and then I'm in talks with I might be doing one on the history of Charlie Records.
Oh, okay.
An old radio friend of mine got in touch, said, you ever heard of the 13th Floor Elevators? They were like a garage band. 60s, early 70s, way back, freaking bad. And yeah, they're I mean, they're really low. Right? I'd never heard of them until I got Six Music, and even now I couldn't really name you any of their song. I know I've heard it. But yeah, so they're interested in, it's the 50th anniversary of Charlie Record, which again, I've never heard of. And they tend to do a lot of reissues, a lot of the old immediate records from the 60s, the Andrew Goldens. So that just popped up. So the ability to be able to do that.
Yeah.
It's comedy and dogs and all the other that I that comes up. And some are just lifestyle. Some, and I kind of worked out a business model that I would kind of be a co-creator with, like Ann and I are business partners on that.
You're right.
But the other ones I do, they pay me just to make it for them. And I don't have any real creative input. They know what they want.
Yeah.
I advised them technically on making it, and they pay me an hourly rate to make it.
Yeah.
And so that gives you a good approach. So I can cover subjects that I have absolutely no knowledge of and minimal interest in as well, to be honest. But, I know there's an audience. There's an audience for everything. You do, they will come for it.
Yeah. And one of the things I talked to Anna about, and, it's clear how enthusiastic and what a passion, canine well-being and nutrition and all the areas around that is. Because even when we're speaking, to each other, we always end up back there because that's what she naturally talks about. That's what she's naturally very, very interested in. And for me, I'm really interested in marketing and how I think that people mystify it a little bit too much and don't really get it. And that's the whole point, marketing made clear is about like making these things a little bit more clear. I think there's loads of analogies, like, I'm dyslexic, so analogies are really important for me to get an understanding of things. But just to try and help people a little bit. Honestly, it's a massive honor to have you on the podcast. So thank you so much. When you started podcasting and making that move from radio, did you ever think that podcasting would be as kind of popular as now? Or
Definitely. Which was the reason I gave up a very comfortable, very well established, pretty senior role in the BBC, with one of the most respected broadcasters in the world. Primarily working for the biggest radio station in Europe, so talking about security. So there's no way I was going to jump ship at the age of 50 unless I thought there was something in this podcasting thing. And what spurred me onto it was, because podcasts have been around for 20-odd years. And I was making podcasts for the BBC back in my Six Music days. And in those days, the BBC were just recutting shows that have been broadcast. So there's, the live broadcast and then sort of the radio equivalent to iPlayer, where you can go back and listen again to the whole show. And then we started making highlight shows were podcasts. And it was kind of hard to explain to the audience what the difference was. There was just, it was on demand, listen when you want it, or the live broadcast. But the podcasts were essentially the radio shows without the music, because at that time, the BBC didn't have the rights to put commercial music on podcasts. So I was making one for George Lamb, who was Fixed Music at the time, and I was the producer of that. And I had a lot of fun. I was just taking the highlights because it was a very speech-heavy show and lots of goofing around and all that. So I made a weekly highlight show, and that was a lot of fun. That did well.
Yeah.
And moved to Radio 2. Again, I didn't make it, but I always said one of the shows in my portfolio, because I was the weekend editor, was Graham Norton. Graham's live radio show would reach 4 million people a week. It was huge. But his podcast, which was just the show without the music, the Grill Grands and the two big interviews, and that was getting 800,000 downloads on its own. And so there was a big audience for it. And for a lot of reasons, the BBC were kind of slow to get into podcasting. And it's mainly because anytime the BBC wants to innovate, there's a lot of commercial backlash. Like, are you getting in that? Right. And podcasts were taking over. And it was after Serial. That a big American series gave NPR essentially public radio in the US, and that was in 2012, and that really made things blow up podcast wise because they've been around but no one had really got into it, and then everyone got into Serial, and that suddenly everybody's talking about podcasts. And then it was around 2016 where news-wise, everything just went mental. Brexit, we had Trump, we had that was the year of the celebrity death, starting with Bowie, then Prince.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was an absolutely landmark year of craziness. And that's when I got really into podcasting. I was just trying to cover the news.
Yeah.
I just ended up following all these different current affairs podcasts. And I got into Positive America, which was created by some of Obama's former speechwriters. And they kind of showed me, they were kind of my role models because they were intelligent, in-depth, but very one-sided ahead. Analysis of the news. So, they're unashamedly Democrats, particularly Trump, but all the Republicans, and they didn't have to be both sides and they didn't have to be balanced. This is their fight back against Fox News. But they also had adverts, to fund it. And the adverts were funny.
I love that.
And they would swear them and they would kind of tie in whatever they're talking about into this. So I thought it was a really clever way of making the advertising content and I could never understand commercial radio in this country why they didn't make adverts enjoyable part of content in the way that TV adverts you'd see on TV a clip one of those list shows the 100 best TV adverts ever and people remember the old Cadbury Hamlet cigar adverts iconic sort of TV moments in themselves as well as TV shows, but there was no equivalent in radio. But in Canada, where I grew up, I can still remember some funny adverts that I heard on radio because they were necessity. So they made them entertaining and I could still remember them for Grizzly Beer and for Pizzaville and Pizza Express and all these sort of brands. And they're still sort of shtick because they were really, really, really funny ads. And we quote as much as we quoted the radio shows we listened to. So I could see that there was a future in podcasting because it gave you freedom. And also it was dependent on the audience either supporting it directly through subscription or a really strong sponsorship or brand association that would pay for or advertising. And so I could see there was a future in it. But again, going back to the BBC, they were slow to get going. And I was kind of frustrated that we weren't doing more in the podcast space. Then they announced that we were going to do podcasting. I've been in the BBC for well over 15 years, pushing on 20 years, and I'd kind of gone as far as I could go. I was never going to be director general. I wasn't going to be director of radio. I wasn't going to be the head of Radio 2. I missed my moment of being head of Six Music and that's another story. So I thought, well, what else am I going to do? And then they announced we're going to do podcasts. And like original podcasts, not just recutting the old shows. Like, excellent. So got together my boss and I and a few others. And we came up with about 15 format ideas, seven on my own for these new sort of standalone podcasts. And we pitched them. We didn't get anything. And I went for some feedback, and the ones that they picked, and out of a big strong 200-300 producers working radio that on all these ideas that we came up with, they were really sort of timidly going, well, we're going to try six pilots. We've got six pilots. We're going to try and see how it goes. And the pilots I could see were really just vehicles for new talent they wanted to try that they didn't have any space for on Radio 4 at the moment.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I just got really frustrated and said, well, and this is like 2017, 2018. And I could see already that BBC is a good year behind the rest of the world when it came to like podcasts were just blowing up. And we were still just kind of toying with it. Well, this,
yeah.
And I did snap my head and said, well, I don't need these guys. I didn't do it myself. So I was in a position financially that I thought, okay, I can jump ship. I can work for myself for a couple of years and launch this, get into podcasting and do it on my own. And then I don't have to pitch it and I don't have to get it commissioned or whatever. I'll just do it. Really the punk ethos. It's really do I want it?
Or will it
end up by a label? Just record it and put it out yourself.
It's
work, but you can do it. And then you've got that complete creative control and you potentially get all 100% of the financial reward if you yeah. make it. So that's what spurred me on, and that's why I got into it. And that's like it's been hard going, like anything else. Everything is it's hard to make it, and people get worried. Oh, there's so many podcasts out there. Well, that's true, but there's a million books, and no one says there's too many books, and there's
yeah.
tons of music out there. No one says there's too much music, and
yeah,
it's too much on Netflix. Actually, enough.
yeah,
always something new, right? So there's room for everything. It's just, and it's probably more your area. It's how do you get noticed? How do you get heard?
Yes,
in the field.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 100%. And I think I'd echo what you're saying there, because for me, I finished my MBA the beginning of last year, actually. And, you know, for me, I found, well, you can go down the route of getting all your academic work published by somebody else or publish it yourself. And so I went down the route of, you know, making my own website, publishing it myself so that I had, you know, creative control. I knew that publishing it through different places, you know, things needed to change. It needed to fit the kind of narrative that certain places had. So I'd have to edit my work a little bit, which took away from what I wanted it to be. And this is an extension of that. I think, you know, I again want to just get my perspective out there, because I do think, like, people don't really get marketing. But when you spend a bit of time with people and you kind of highlight things, people go, oh yeah, all right, I get it. I think like you said, with a podcast, marketing a podcast is like what is its own kind of skill set, and it's very difficult. I think it's going to be very different than a product kind of marketing strategy that you put together. It's a service, really. And part of it is looking at which platforms are performing well. But if people really like a podcast, they'll go and use whatever platforms they're on if they want to engage with it. So I don't think that matters too much. And I was just thinking that move that you made from radio to podcast as well is really interesting. It's probably you had that experience of the startup mentality and the talk radio, which became TalkSport. I mean, one of the things I was going to ask is, did you ever see that becoming like the giant that it is today? And obviously, you know, with Six Music as well, the startup kind of that you were there right at the beginning for that as well.
Yeah. Obviously, you get into these things hoping that it's going to be big. And it's usually a hard slog. You know, in those days, I was particularly at talk radio. I mean, I was pretty junior. I produced the overnight show for 3 years, which was the best time. So I didn't have any sort of, I think, vested in its success. Other than, you know, I wanted to do well so that,
yeah,
you know, I had a job and that, you know, just do what I was talking about when I said where I worked, they knew what I meant. But I do remember us thinking, you know, in the early days of talk radio, as it was then, you know, our chief competitor was Five Live. And at that time, Five Live was getting about 5 million listeners a week or whatever. I think they still get something around like that. Between 5 and 7, whatever it is. And, you know, in our early days, we were getting, you know, less than 1 million, I think, at talk radio. But we did believe that, you know, within a few years, we will be as big as Five Live. I don't think they'd ever got there. I think when I was at talk radio, the highest we got was 2 million. Then Kelvin McKenzie bought it and gradually was introducing more sport into it. And then eventually, 2000, we turned it into talk sport. Again, I don't know what, in terms of traditional reach, I think they thought, you know, we'll get a couple million. Again, we'll compete with Five Live on the sports side. But I think what they did is that they diversified it more, and they could see other avenues of, you know, phone in lines and charging and other sort of business models. And then I think the digital revolution of DAB and online listening just kind of made it so that your overall reach, and this kind of happened in commercial radio as well, where they have a brand that kind of goes everywhere, and you got absolute 80s after the 90s. You know, you could really niche and really narrow it because your overall brand is doing well, but you're not so each station's reach in the traditional sense. So the thinking back and when I was starting there was that we knew who our main competitor was, and we thought we could reach that and surpass it. And the same with Sick. I remember having this, it was weird. The first Radar, the first time we got Radars, we were getting 158,000 listeners a week. And I remember my boss at the time, Anthony Belcom, saying, well, the radio is coming out. So, how do you think we did? And I kind of said, I don't know, 500,000. But you know, we were happy with it. And it was funny because Six Music launched at the same time as BBC Seven, which became Four Extra. And actually, the three of us all, these sort of digital offshoots of established bands. So Radio One had One Extra, Radio Four had Seven, and by more by default than any real symbiosis, Radio Two had Six Music. And we were, in those early days, we really were the poor man, because One Extra looked really, really funky and new, and was reaching a young, you know, urban audience that wasn't getting really served anywhere else. BBC7 had all this great archive of all this old great Hancock's Half Hour, all those old great Radio 4 comedies. And Six Music was just seen as this chin-stroking albums and archive, old John sessions and playing Echo and the Bunnymen until your head fell off. You know, that's how we kind of dismissed that for all time. And it was the threat of closure when we realized actually people really did care about the station and there were more people who were listening. And our audience was 600. It gradually was getting bigger and bigger. We were always behind our rivals. So digitally was One Extra and BBC Seven. We're always doing better than we did. Our other DAB rivals like Planet Rock, we're winning digital station of the year every year and getting way more audience than us. And then Analog, you know, XFM. So they were kind of our indie guitar rock rivals. And we were always second to, we're always fighting against them and losing, as it were. They're threatening, and which is one of the reasons I think no one's listening to this station, no one cares, let's shut it down. And then everyone, you know, went mental. And then it focused on us on what Six Music actually was, which was, you know, this alternative spirit of rock, or also this spirit of alternative music. And it did matter to a lot of people, and not, you know, the songwriter, PRS, the music industry, everyone came to our defense. And then suddenly we had 695,000 listeners a week to well over a million. Now they're resting nicely around 2.5 million listeners a week. And I always thought we could get there, but I remember having this argument with Mark Riley. You know, he's got his particular view on you know, that sort of alternative music. And he just didn't believe there was enough people. Like, he said, I don't think there's more than a million people who listen to a station like Six, as he saw it. And his work, which is what Stan and Gideon and the Evening Stuff did, no playlist, you know, play what you want whenever you want, and you know, start your show with a hard to listen to 20-minute track or whatever. Yeah, he would do all that because he thought that's what music lovers would like. But he acknowledged that there was probably only about a million of them in the country, and you know, whereas others thought, well, you can appeal to that, but there's also a lot of other music like, or, you know, there's more of them. You need to soften the edges a bit more.
So that's a very marketing kind of look at view as well, because, you know, if you're looking at companies like, you know, ones that I've worked for when you're developing products and you're trying to develop a product, you're thinking, is there a market for this? You know, is there an audience for this? It also, in an industry we both worked in, which is the music industry, for A&R guys, you know, to think, you know, like, this band might be brilliant, I might love them, but is it, you know, is there an audience out there that we can market this to? Is there some, you know, is there a group that we can say, this is our audience, and can we put this product, let's say, in front of them, whether that be, you know, a band, a live shows, album, whether we're talking about a radio station, whether we're talking about podcasts, you know, it's the same thing, you know, it's identifying an audience and then targeting them with it.
Yeah. And the thing about podcasting is there really is an audience for anyone. I've come across things like, well, I didn't even know this existed, let alone there's people who are passionate about it. I was a judge for the British Podcasting Awards a couple of years ago, and I was upping to go through it, and there was a podcast about bats, and particularly like pond bats and bats in the wild. And I listened, and it was brilliant, you know, because I think you mentioned this earlier, it was the passion of the presenter. They were just buzzed about seeing this bat in the rafters of this barn. It was captivating listening. I didn't know anything about bats, and wouldn't necessarily, but it was just their enthusiasm is so infectious. But it just goes to show the if you're interested in it, someone else is as well. It's just, how do you get them to know that you're doing it? I did this series for this thing, this online course. It was all about, you know, starting a podcast for this brand. I think it went under. But one of the things I made this joke of, you know, if you're into 13th century Gregorian chants, because there's someone else's, well, you just, but if you do your podcast and it's produced well and it sounds good and it's well researched and it's knowledgeable and passionate and well produced, you know, other people who are like 13th century Gregorian chants will love it as well.
Yeah.
Getting them to know about it. That's goes back to the market. Like, how do you get people to try it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, for sure. I think I'm targeting this podcast at people who are either getting into marketing, sometimes new to marketing, just maybe somebody that's got an interest in marketing that wants to, you know, keep their ideas fresh, keep, you know, a fresh view on it. Because I think, like, after a while, sometimes on certain things, you can stagnate a little bit. And when you just need that spark of somebody talking about it who really, you know, is passionate about it to reignite that again, to get that going again. And so, yeah, totally get that. The difference with my one, I think, will be is that it's also going to be a bit of a creative outlet for my music side as well. So I'm trying to integrate music into it a little bit, you know. So writing, I've got a theme song, I've got like some backing music over parts of the intro, and there's kind of different sections in each of the podcast which I've got little like backing songs for.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a bit of fun.
I mean, that's part of the thing that I enjoy this while I'm doing is that, and again, the tools are pretty easy to use, the grind, yeah, and stuff like that. So Anna's theme song, Her Dog's Life, that's me. I did all that. And I just said to her, when I first started, because, you know, Anna's like way out there in a bit, like, oh. And I thought she'd want some ethereal sort of synths and chill music and all that. And so, well, what kind of theme music do you have in mind? She went, oh, something like Walking a Dog by the Stones. You know? I'm like,
nice.
That
sound like a...
Oh, man. And I just played that riff backwards.
Oh, okay, right. I didn't realize that was you. I know, because you're a guitarist and a bassist, aren't you?
I play mainly guitar, but I play bass and drums and all that. So I just recorded that theme on GarageBand. And so I played it, and she wanted it Stonesy, so I played it on my Telecaster in open G, like Keith Richards. And as I kind of did that riff backwards and made a 12-bar Stonesy bluesy and a bit of slide guitar over it. And then on my keyboard, I did drums.
Yeah.
Did the drum. So it was like three guitars, bass, drums, and I think a bit of piano on it.
Yeah.
But I just had fun. And then I've got, you know, a minute version from the beginning, and I've got like a 2-minute version for the end.
Yeah.
And then I did an acoustic version for it. A time for subject if we wanted a softer version of it, you know, so. And I've done a piano version, so you know you can. And I've done that with a couple podcasts. I did one with Nathan Cassidy called Psych Comedy, one of the comedy podcasts I do. And I did two versions of that, and it was just a couple of drum loops, drum beats I liked, and because it was called Psych Comedy, I was thinking of Psycho, you know. So I just kind of did that stab really high up on the guitar, like a really high C.
Yeah.
And then I just came up with this bass riff behind.
Yeah.
And then I came up with two versions. And he sent me Nathan, goes, I like them both. And so do I. So one became the opening theme and the other is the closing theme. And the
character. Very cool.
Yeah. So that's again, part of the fun. And, you know, if I was doing, you know, for want of a better word, a professional radio show, it would be to see with someone else. The idea that I would be able to write and record my own theme for my show would probably not go down well. But with podcasts, you wait with it. So if you take your podcast, you can, I need a little bit of this. Well, you can spend hours searching through some free online music library. You go, I'll just self and do it.
It's far more enjoyable for me to do it myself as well. And it kind of becomes this mishmash amalgamation of a bunch of ideas and everything. So I really like that. And I'm going to go back and listen to the intro to Anna's podcast and totally different light. I think I'll be listening to that.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
The thing they use for, because I'm also in a band and music for the band, and I'll periodically come up with a riff where it's doesn't really go anywhere and it's not really a thing. It's catchy, but it of itself, but when it's up to you, I use that for a theme song or
yeah,
but I've got tons and tons of things.
Yeah, same.
Art that aren't going to be songs or anything, but
yeah,
being for some sort of little mini library, I'll just be that for that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm the same. I definitely, my writing style probably suits jingles more than it does, like, you know, full songs anyway. So yeah, that's really cool. And I guess one of the things is I feel like I owe you an apology, because I've been on Anna's podcast 3 times and sitting and editing my own interviews and podcasts and stuff, I've realized how much I am and are. So apologies for all the editing that you have to do on the podcast I was on. I think that when it comes to radio and podcast, there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that people don't see. I think people know that, you know, a producer exists. You often when you listen to radio, you do hear presenters say, I'm going to talk to my producer, or I was talking to my producer, and so on, and know that they're, but I don't know that everybody really knows what a producer is and what they necessarily do. So as somebody that's very experienced, has been a producer, what is a producer?
Well, it's a kind of a catch-all phrase for a number of different tasks, depending on the format, the presenter. So we can go from someone who really is just there to kind of make sure everything technically goes right, to someone who is really on top of every detail, who's written the script, telling the presenter everything we need to do, has programmed everything. So when I was a producer of the talk radio, my job was to kind of work with the presenter generally, what the subject matter would be, what our angle would be on it. And then I would probably do some of the research, trying to back up our argument with some facts, or I would have an assistant who I would say, can you get me some bad examples? Because every day I just would say, what are the latest on NHS waiting lists? Yeah. So we have that fact to hand. So I would have that and you put that in some sort of document that the presenter would have to go there. Then once you're live on air, doing talk radio, you might have booked a guest, so you're briefing the guest on what you're talking about. You might give a little bit of a little bio for the presenter. Do you know who you're talking to? Or get with your assistant to do that. That's it. It's interesting. There's some admin stuff. There's planning stuff. There's writing. You might physically record it, or you might have an engineer record it. You tell them what you want to do. Producing is hands-on, or as hands-off as you want it to be for that particular show with Warren. In music radio, again, it depends on what the show is, who the presenter is. So a daytime show in Radio 2 or 6 Music, a lot of the music programmed by the network. So you're the producer of a daytime radio show with work with the presenter about the other stuff, you know, to make sure that they say this particular thing about what the network's doing or what's coming up, or here's some facts about the song, and you can make sure that they have that information. You kind of keep it to time. You can see, okay, he's got 2 minutes to fill before the news. So your song, so you're talking about this, and you a note. If it's a pre-recorded show, some producers, well, in the old days, you know, they would have an engineer. Now the producers would record and edit and schedule it all themselves. They're much more hands-on. So it could be, you know, and if you have a presenter who's hired because they're really knowledgeable and they picked all the music, like a special show like Iggy Pop, say, on 6 Music. So Iggy would pick all that music. He'd pre-record this, so he's not live. So his producer, Adam, would, Iggy would just give him a list of songs all on the play. So Adam's job would to put them in the right order. So So that song is a good way to start the hour and to start the show with that song.
Yeah. These
3 tracks together make a nice sequence. And so Adam would kind of take Iggy's list and put them in order. Then he would record Iggy introducing the song and talk about him. If he didn't know much about the track. He just liked it. Adam would have sent him information about who that artist is, what label they're on, if they're on tour, any of that kind of selling material. And then Adam would just shape that. So he would take the sort of raw stuff, listen to music from Iggy and whatever Iggy had to say about it, and then shape it into a nice show that you would hear every week. And then other shows, I mean, you literally, I've produced some shows where I've picked all the music, I've written all the links, you know, and then I've given it to them, then I've sat in the studio while they read the script, word for word as it's written it. And then I take away, and even like a seasoned professional broadcaster like Bob Harris, who can program all the music and make write all his own links and do it, but he's also available to, you know, he's also capable of doing what you want him. And again, back in the early days of Six Music, we used to mark the anniversaries. In the early days of Six Music was the archive, the BBC, mainly Radio 1 archive of concerts they recorded. And again, I had a lot of freedom. It was part of my job then, you know, this is a kind of, I was a team leader of this events team. We to go cover Glastonbury, or we'd find an
act
and try and do like a network-wide project that everyone got involved with to celebrate some sort of anniversary. And that would be big or small. It might be Smith's Week. We did one time to mark the 20th anniversary of the release of Hand in Glove. And or we do small ones. And, you know, it was marking the death of Mark Ronson. And it was called Ronson Remembered. And I knew that the BBC had recorded this tribute concert to Mark Ronson. And I knew that Bob Harris had hosted it. And we were there. So I wrote a script.
Yeah.
Bob saying, "Hi, I'm Bob Harris. Welcome to it." And I wrote forward what him to say as much as I could. And I programmed all the tracks and
whoever
appeared at that gig. And I got to a point where, because I wasn't there at the time, so I'd say, in brackets, Bob, it'd be nice if he could say what it was like when Brian May came on stage or whatever. I remember. And actually, I couldn't be there for that recording. I got someone else to record it for me over the meeting. And then they went and recorded, and Bob just wasn't playing me. He was just recording the script for me. And I was going to assemble it all later. And then there was these funny signs where he's like, "Hi, I'm Bob Harris, and welcome to McRotch and You Remember It." And you hear him off by, "Phil, Mike wants me to say something about Brian May. I don't remember Brian being there. I should remember much of that because I know he was there, but I don't remember." And it was hilarious.
So you received that recording with all of that on it?
Well, the outtakes have been things. I just kind of did. A producer can be someone who literally just sits there, makes sure the presenter finishes on time, to being in control of absolutely everything on that. And for a phone-in show, you direct, you screen the callers, or you oversee how the caller, what callers get to wear. You deal with what the presenters are saying on time, or you book the guests, you do the research, or you delegate that to someone who gets the research and check it all. The music radio, sometimes you're programming everything. Sometimes you're just making sure the presenter is that the information, the music's been programmed for them. It's a quite a wide ranging job to do, and it's one of those jobs where you can't always fully describe. It's like, you know, like as you go up the ladder, the executive producer or as the radio, BBC Radio would call them an editor. When I was, you know, weekend editor of Radio 2, people would have done me a hard discussion. I was in charge of every show that went out on Radio 2 over the weekend from midnight Saturday all the way to midnight Sunday, and that was nine shows. And I had people like Tony Blackburn and Graham Chin and Terry Wogan and Lisa Tarbuck, you know, big broadcasting legends. And again, some of those shows were very self-created. Like Lisa Tarbuck would program all her music, so I didn't have any, and she had a producer in the studio with her, so I was again overseeing it, making sure knew what the network was doing. There might be some network one things like Hyde Park was something that I left Dacker, Radio 2 Live in Hyde Park. So I would make sure everyone had the right information about what was done, how to promote it, yada, yada, yada. Graham Norton, again, you know, I didn't have direct input into the content of the shows week by week, but I would oversee that, you know, the shows weren't clashing with each other guest wise. I would, they all work together. But it was kind of a nebulous, really kind of hard rule to define exactly what I did weekend, other than having a lot of meetings and being up on what they're doing. But I wasn't in the studio making it. And again, and this is why, going back to why I jumped ship, was I kind of missed that hands-on creation of making something. I'd pop in the studio to say hi. Someone cool came in and going to meet him or something like that. In this studio, I didn't make the shows, but very, very rarely. I tended to just catch up with the producer, and then I was a conduit between what the producers and the presenters were thinking.
Yeah.
Senior management, and I can tell them what you're in, and back and forth. It was kind of a middleman. It was proper middle management, which had its
ups and downs, I guess.
It was benefits in some ways and cool in some ways, and TDC boring in other ways.
Yeah.
That's the sort of making stuff. So I got in the podcast with the view of actually being able to record, edit, and make the thing that I heard in my head.
Yeah, and I think, like, from my side, approaching it as well, my background in music with, you know, I spent 3 years studying record production, among other things. So, you know, learned from the very best about Pro Tools and recording techniques. I do think I would struggle a little bit if I hadn't had that. You know, even though you get GarageBand free when you get a laptop or anything. But it's funny, actually, when I was looking at the podcast that you have and the podcast that you're directly involved in, because, like, music-wise, I used to, when I was younger, I used to get sent away on these, like, residential camps. And, you know, you'd go and you'd spend a week with a couple of, like, quite high-profile musicians to learn from. And one of the guys I was on the course with, this guy, I don't know if you've heard of Greg Bissonette. He's a drummer. He plays with David Lee Roth. Well, he was the drummer for David Lee Roth when he left Van Halen.
Right.
He was Joe Satriani's drummer. He played for Electric Light Orchestra and Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. He was the drummer for as well. But the big one for me, especially at the time, was he was and still is the drummer for Spinal Tap. And so they did a Q&A thing with him. And one of the questions I said, and obviously the famous thing about drummers blowing up, he's the longest standing drummer they've ever had. So probably because they're not gigging that much.
Yeah.
But they did a Q&A, and one of the questions I asked him was, I think those guys are hilarious, the Spinal Tap guys. And when they're doing their thing and, you know, I don't know, the tiny Stonehenge is coming down, I said, how do you not just, like, lose your because being a drummer, if you were doing that, I you'd lose it. And he just said, I just lose it sometimes. It's hilarious working with those guys, and you know, it just, you're not meant to, I guess, as to take that as a producer. You work with the guys on the Idiots of the World podcast, and my question to you would be, like, how do you not lose it when those guys are being hilarious? Or
I do. But again, that goes back to my radio days, live broadcasting, that I learned to laugh silently. I knew when it was appropriate the person I'm laughing, and I knew when it's not, but I'm still laughing. And
yeah,
so in my early days of talk radio, I used to work with Ian Collins, and we had a show called Ian Collins and Creatures of the Night. And I would be on air with Ian and my sidekick. And the three of us would be on air at part, not the whole show, but we'd come on the beginning, chat, and then we would laugh, have a laugh on air. And then when the mics were down, Ian would say something funny to call us, and I'd laugh a lot anyway. But there were times when it wasn't appropriate to laugh. My mic was up, but I can't laugh. And again, with George Lamb, I'd be on air with him, and I would learn not to laugh. It doesn't always work, because sometimes you control. And I guess it's something that you develop over time, that your brain says it's appropriate to laugh out loud.
Yeah.
And it says, nope, you can't laugh it. So it is,
we'll laugh about that later or something.
You kind of hold it in and you're shaking, but you're not good. And I guess it's like, you know, when you're a kid, when you're giggling in school, in class, or you know, it's inappropriate, which makes you laugh even harder. But
I know, yeah, that's what I was going to say, because if you're trying to hold it in,
you're dying. So it's like that in professional life, where you just learn to control it a bit better. And the thing with the Egypt is that I recorded, you know, just the way our diaries work, I'm not always there when they record. And so to get them going, I taught them how to record themselves, what equipment. So I advised them, again, one of the services to keep costs down.
Yeah.
I'm not always involved.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Glenn lives in Ipswich and Andrew lives down near Folkestone, and they go down and Glenn goes down to Andrew's. And so the first couple I went down and I advised them while we're talking about what the show was going to be and this and how they wanted to do it. And I go, well, here's the mic you want to buy. This is what you're going to record it on. I'll come down. These are the levels. So the first few episodes I recorded for them until they were confident in doing it themselves. And now it was, again, save on time and cost, make things more efficient. They record it. And then Andrew listens back to it and he sends me the audio. And because also they're filming it for YouTube and they want to do more visual stuff.
Okay.
Andrew's son Flynn does that side. So they send me the audio and Andrew will make notes of, you know, Glenn too near the knuckle, you cut that out. And I just, well, so I freely laugh along.
You know. Yeah.
If it's late on Tuesday night, I try not to laugh out loud because I don't want to bother Colette because she's in there watching TV and I'm here pissing myself laughing. She gets annoyed. But in that first episode, when we were first doing the pilot, I don't know if we ever released that one. I think we were just playing around with it. I was just bent over, just dying. But knowing that I can't, and I could have. I guess it could have been fine to laugh in the background because sometimes I like that. You hear laughing in the background.
Yeah, exactly. It's a style, isn't it?
Sometimes it sounds a bit naff, like, this zoo format's getting out of control and they're all laughing to kind of make it sound funnier than it is. And
yeah.
I don't know. It's I'm of two minds with that because I was doing radio myself and I was on air laughing out loud in the background. And sometimes, you know, I get in trouble for it from my boss saying, that's bad,
right?
You know, just so that. Because there's a fear that it's exclusive
to the listener at home that, oh, these clowns
laughed in amongst themselves and you're being excluded. So that's the fear of it.
Yeah.
Enough, because, you know, as I say, I'm from Canada, and thanks to the internet, I can listen to baseball games on my phone, and which I do late at night. And I was listening to a game last night, and on the station where I got one of my first jobs was working for the sports station in Toronto, and I was listening to the Toronto Blue Jays baseball game. And I was like, I don't know any of the guys working there. Now, this is 30 years ago, over 30 years ago. But I was listening to it, and the guy was talking. And then he made some joke, and I could hear the producer in the background laughed off in the distance a couple of times ago. And I hadn't heard that quite before on that
stage.
I remember getting in trouble for doing that.
I think it comes down to whether it's meant to be, you know, a lot of the things about podcasts is that them being an intimate thing between the podcaster and the listener. But then it depends on the format, because say like Anna's format where she's usually interviewing somebody, well, it's not so much directed at, you know, the dialogue isn't necessarily directed at the listener. It's directed in the style of an interview. So it's a little bit different. Well, thanks, Will. You've had an amazing career. It's amazing. I think there's so much that, myself, other people can learn from all the things that you've done. I really appreciate you like kind of spilling the beans a little bit. And I guess that, like, just in closing, it'd be, you know, do you have any advice for me as a fledgling podcaster?
Well, I would just say, I guess the thing I've learned about running a podcast is when I first got it, I was really excited. Like, I'll just do anything. Yeah, we'll just try it. If it doesn't work, well, we'll do something else. And it was a real Wild West mentality, which I liked. I was really excited. Like, anything goes. And if it doesn't, we'll try something else. What I've realized is that there is a bit of work and graft that goes into and just getting it off the ground in the first place. As easy as it is and as less arduous as it is trying to get a TV show off or make a movie or anything that involves big budgets and loads of people. But there's still a lot of work to get done. And you want to make sure that you're going to do that without wasting your time. What's the point of doing artwork and equipment and coming to format and recording all the stuff after a couple of episodes go, it's not working, I'm unborned, or it's not what I thought it would be. So think about it. So the first question I ask someone is like, well, why do you want to do a podcast?
Mm.
If your answer is, well, everyone else is done. Well, that's not good reason.
Nice.
And then the second question is, you know, well, who's going to listen to it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know who your audience is, well, you're probably not going to have an idea what the show is going to be. And within those first two questions also is, you know, what do you expect to get out? You have to have reasonable expectations. You know, if you think you're going to be the next Joe Rogan, well, good luck to you. I hope, but my gut tells you, you're probably not going to get $1 million a month and sign $100 million contract with Spotify. I don't think it's going to work for you that way. I think you're going to have to think about, you know, maybe you're going to get, you know, a couple thousand downloads a month, which is not bad. And if you got a targeted audience and A, you're not financially dependent on that, and it's something you like to do, and it's a creative outlet for you, or it's fulfilling some sort of marketing or business need for you that's not necessarily monetization, or there's where you can monetize that, great. Or it's part of an overall package, great. And if you're very clear in your head what those objectives are, then you're great. And that can be applied to anything in music. Okay? I was listening to, and it's all relative, you know, you got to keep in mind, what is success to you? And I was listening to a guy who wrote the CVL Emirate, his name is. He's an American author, and it was American Fiction, which is out on Amazon Prime now. It was based on a book that he wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Funny enough, I read it. He's done a new version of Huckleberry Finn, but based on the perspective of Jim the Slate. And it's very interesting. But the reason I mentioned that is because he was on the Today program, and he mentioned a stat that just goes how relative everything is in terms of whatever creative field you're in. He said, you know, if I sell 70,000 books, that's pretty good. If I made a TV show and 70,000 people saw it, that'd be a big failure. If I made a movie and 70,000 people saw it, that'd be a big failure.
Mm.
I was thinking in podcasts, you know, or he said, if you sold 70,000 records, it might be all right. You know, if you got 70,000 downloads a month on your podcast, you are in the big leagues and you're going to be doing well, and you can monetize that really, really well. If you were getting 70,000 streams on Spotify, you're probably doing good business. You ain't going to make any money from it, but that probably means you may hit fan base that you can shift record or do sell a lot of gig tickets. But yeah, if you're getting 70,000 TV viewers, that's really, really bad. And if you make a feature film and 70,000 people watch it, that's a disaster.
Yeah, that, yeah.
But it's all how numbers are relative. So again, I know I'm kind of being long-winded here in my answers, and good luck editing all this stuff down. But it's what success to you?
Yeah.
Yes. But I would say that, you know, my advice is do it if it doesn't cost a lot, and you're clear in your head what it is you want to do and why you're doing it.
And
if it's just to have fun or it's just to fight your marketing, you know, I don't expect a million people listening, but I want the right people listening. Like a good example is I met at a podcast conference, I met a guy who runs a company. They do a podcast for the insurance industry.
Oh, right. Okay.
And, you know, that's pretty limited. But he says there's, you know, 6,000 insurance brokers in the UK, 1,500 listening to his podcast. So he's got a quarter of that market.
So exactly.
So 1,500 downloads is not big
in
the grand scheme of podcasting. But if you've got a quarter of your target audience, that's amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Being funded by the Insurance Brokerage Association of the UK or whatever it is. But all the information they want to get to the book is they're reaching a quarter of them through that podcast. That's a massive success. So it's how you measure success. What do you want from it? Let's do it. And how are you going to measure success?
Yeah. And I guess the other thing would be like the perspective earlier you said about the Bat podcast, you know, if they're reaching more than just the people that are interested in bats and the level they are, then the other thing is that they're reaching slightly more people to get more interest into that group and building that group. So that's a totally different thing, way of looking at it too. So,
And the other thing to bear in mind is that they're there forever. You know, we've had a commercial partnership with Paleo, and we've had with other people, and then I just let them know that the podcast that we put out 2 years ago that were a brand association or supported by a particular brand, people are still listening to that.
Yeah. So
the money that they spent, the marketing money they spent in 2021 is still feeling not the same impact they had when it first came out, but we're still getting downloads on the show. And that message is still baked into that growth. So when we tell people go back and listen to the back catalog, and they are doing those numbers obviously go up. new people keep stumbling upon it. So that message is still relevant. And if we were bigging up a brand or a book or whatever, people will still get the benefit of that because they will forever.
Yeah.
Unless I physically go in and delete those episodes from the hosting platform, they're out there forever. And people do either for a variety of reasons still come across those old episodes. The numbers for those continue to rise. And so the lifespan and the long tail of those, that marketing message.
Yeah.
Whereas the argument Ann and I always have with potential people who we ask to, kind of sponsor, you come on as a sponsor and say, this is the price. They go, ooh, that's a lot of money. And I go, well, yeah, but it'll be there forever. You'll happily spend that money on a magazine, quarter page ad in a magazine.
Yeah.
We'll not really sink in. If it's in the Metro, it'll flip through it and fling it away. And then it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas this is, people are listening. They're listening intently.
Yeah.
Listening because they trust the host. If the host says, buy Paleo, it's not raw dog food out there. People are going to take that on board and take it seriously and act upon it. And that message will is going to be there forever.
Yeah.
And as the past pros and new people come across it and go, well, I enjoy that. What else have they done? And here's something about raw dog food. All Dogs Matter, whatever they might find interesting, they will go back and check it out.
Yeah. I think it's like you said, it's the long tail effect. It's that, yes, you'll get an instant impact, but there's the long, the longevity, the long tail effect. And if, with marketers, the pressure is always about measuring return on investment. Well, if you measure the return on investment after week one, it's going to be different to week four, week 52, and so on, really. So, I think, it is a really rewarding platform. And again, I do see a big move that companies are going to have to move to podcast. If they want to reach a certain level of consumers. You said they're about 25% of insurance brokers. Well, they might be the 25% of insurance brokers that aren't reading the emails as well. There's the other thing, aren't reading a publication or something. So yeah, it's a multi-channel approach. So yeah, no, I think that's a really, really, really good point. Yeah, well, thanks so much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Cool. All right, man. Well,
yeah.
I don't get to do this kind of stuff. Gosh, I'm about myself. So is it fun?
Yeah. No, honestly, I can't thank you enough. And I did also say to Anna, the part of the reason I'm doing this is being on the podcast, meeting you guys, and, that's really inspired me to do this. So thank you for that as well, honestly.
No problem.
Yeah.
So I absolutely loved speaking to Mike about his career. So Mike has been hugely influential in the field of radio in the startup period with so many great institutions that we know about, like BBC Six Music and Talk Radio, to name a few. And I think for this series on podcasting, it's really interesting to see how Mike took that leap of faith, which is something that just keeps coming up, by the way. But Mike took the leap of faith to move into podcasting and is now influencing that field now. Some of my key takeaways from Mike was that although podcasting offers creative control and the potential for financial reward, but it can be hard work. Mike said about doing a podcast on Charlie Records, and Charlie Records was founded in France in 1974, but then moved to the UK when the founder Jean-Luc Young moved over. Charlie was originally known for American-originated jazz and other modern oddities, but is now mainly an album-orientated retro label. I was really fascinated to hear about all the different aspects of launching radio shows and the origins of Six Music and Talk Radio. But in business, we can be so focused on the bottom line, the money, the revenue. But it seems novel to be focused on audience size. But for commercial radio, the bigger the reach, the bigger the advertising revenues. And for the BBC, if a programme or radio station isn't attracting a sustainable audience, it's not a sustainable programme. As we discussed, when marketing a podcast, it's essential to reach and engage with the target audience. The growth of podcasting has created new opportunities for content creators, but finding your niche and targeting a specific audience is key to podcast success. I love the story of the Bat podcast. I might have to give that a listen, actually. I like bats. And 13th century Gregorian chants is my thing, actually. And creating theme music for podcasts can be fun. I really enjoy writing various little bits of music that go into my podcasts, I've also experimented with some AI music generation that I can later use and edit, mixing in my own recorded music. But if you get the chance, please check out Anna Webb's podcast with Mike, which is called A Dog's Life, and you'll hear the theme that Mike was talking about that he played. And just try and think of Walking the Dog by the Rolling Stones. I listen to that podcast a lot, so now I've heard it and gone back to listen to it, I can actually hear that in the song. I just hope that the Rolling Stones don't do a bittersweet symphony thing on them and do what they did to the Verve. But if you have no idea what I'm talking about, that look it up, because that's a crazy story as well, by the way. But Mike is clearly a very talented musician, and it must be great to be able to express himself in that way. I know that I'm enjoying it with my podcast. So in summary of what Mike was saying about being a producer, the role of a producer in radio and podcasting can vary, from technical support to script writing and research. As Mike said, it's quite a wide-ranging job, but I think it was really interesting to hear Mike's perspective on that again. And there's a bit of crossover there on the topic of Glastonbury, because Mike and I have both worked at that festival in different areas. I actually worked on the medical side, whereas Mike worked obviously in the production recording for BBC. And Mike mentioned Colette Cooper, and I mentioned Colette in the intro as well, his lovely other half. So Colette is actually a multi-talented singer, writer and performer, and she's a critically acclaimed artist. They've got a lovely little dog called Billy. So kind of in closing, some brilliant advice there from Mike for fledgling podcasters like myself. It's obviously important to have clear objectives and reasonable expectations. Podcasts can have a long-term impact and can reach targeted audiences, but it can be a grind. Like Mike said, it's all relative, because my target audience is predominantly marketers or people looking to get into marketing, or business owners that might be interested in learning a bit more about marketing. And that audience is going to be restricted in some way. I can't expect to get the same number of downloads as a podcast that has a much wider topic. But my expertise is in marketing, so that's what I'm focused on. And as Mike said, podcasts are there forever. So there's a definite element there of legacy to starting a podcast. And that's definitely part of the appeal for me. From a company perspective, sponsoring a podcast can be a great long-term investment. Because if that podcast is getting good engagement, then you'll continue to get reach and engagement for your adverts in the future. Perhaps the only drawback would be that if you're promoting something that isn't really a long-term offer or product, then it goes out of date, you might run into some problems because you'll still be kind of advertising it or communicating that on that podcast. If you don't know what the long tail effect is, then stick that into Google and have a little look at a graph, but it basically illustrates the long-term impact of anything in a particular way. So although podcast advertising will have an instant impact, there will still be engagement over a longer period of time. That's basically what I'm trying to get at anyway. So massive, massive thanks to Mike. I really, really enjoyed having him on the podcast, and I'm really thankful for him and Anna for inspiring me to do this as well. So here's a listen to that theme one more time. Enjoy.
Marketing made clear, we're here to educate from beginners to pros. We'll elevate, bringing the insights like a blazing spark. Together we'll conquer, leaving our